course. We are dead. We are all dead.
We're supposed to make the world a better place. What happened?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I know Kung Fu.
You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become a villain.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
This whole thing is insane. This whole thing is insane.
300 years ago, you'd have been burned at the stake.
What do all men of power want? More power.
This is now the United States of Zombieland.
This whole thing is insane.
Man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction.
Everybody is stuck with the things that they're not proud of.
More power.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
More power.
There can be only one.
Are you a God-fearing man, Senator? That's such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher, as a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really are afraid of is me.
Happy heresies and welcome to the desert of the real. Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is. Especially with the latest AB Live. Audio version for thee in this eternal now. We celebrated the equinox with some hermetic gnosis. Rampong returned to the virtual Alexandria, and he took us on a visual, archaeological, and astro-theological tour of ancient Egypt. We discovered the actual location and secrets of Thoth's Hall of Records. Expect pyramids of Egyptian lore, Edgar Cayce, Hermeticism, Atlantis, and some alien stuffy stuff. You know, we also touch upon modern pop culture and social issues as they related to arcane mysticism. Full show for everyone, as this was a celebration of sorts, and there is still more content to come before September ends. Thank you to those of you who support this Red Pill Cafeteria. You are amazing, and your backing, company, and feedback help grow this podcast. We need Gnosis more than ever in this age of Hermes, Philip K. Dick world, and Gnostic times. Expect more violence, wars, rising addiction and suicide rates, mass depression, and societal collapse until more look inward while breaking the outward spell of Yaldibaldi and his Epstein angels. You won't find this high-quality Gnostic and Hermetic wisdom, or many of my guests and their unique insights, anywhere else in cyberspace or even meat space. Don't forget my voice-over availability for any podcast, commercial, audiobook, documentary, or whatevs. I'll bring you stellar results with down-to-home professionalism. Other than that, let us to our latest AB Live. In one of my recent Santo Daime astral flights in Portugal, I beheld the universe as one eternal machine. A voice kept telling me, it's all a machine, over and over again. Is this good or is this bad? Let's find out. And with this show, perhaps we can get closer to feeling the pulse of the machine. Upcoming clip from Love, Robots, and Death.
Wake up. Wake up.
Martha Kifelsen.
You're dead, Burton. Stop it, okay?
Not Burton.
Look. I don't have time to figure out what unresolved psychological conflicts gave rise to whatever this shit is, okay? Gotta keep it together. Fucking hallucination.
Look at
The marble index of a mind forever, voyaging through strange eons of thought, alone.
I was the world in which I walked, and what I saw or heard or felt came not but from myself.
It's like a highway into her mind. It sounds like a machine.
And now I see, with eyes serene, the very pulse of the machine.
You're saying that this moon, Io, is a machine. And that machine is you. If you're a machine, what is your function?
To know you. Maybe death. Maybe life. Join with me.
Maybe I'm gonna live forever. Or maybe this is just one last dream.
And we rejoice because we are live. A bit of a different introduction. Excuse me. Never a bad time to have a little introduction to Gnosticism. Not the usual nipples for men introduction, but I'm sure a lot of men's nipples are hard on this first day of fall. I know here in the Midwest, it's already like 20 degrees cooler, and I don't like that. But I hope you've enjoyed, for those of you live or on video, this little introduction, and welcome everybody. Welcome, as always, to the Desert of the Real. We don't take prisoners, we liberate them. We are not the final authority on anything, but hope to be an endless possibility for everything. You are the final authority, and you come here to the virtual Alexandria seeking that old-time gnosis. So, very special show tonight. We are celebrating the autumn equinox, and I can't think of anybody better to celebrate than my friend and the enigmatic and brilliant Graham Pong. Graham, how are you, and welcome.
Thank you, Miguel. I'm doing pretty well. I want to sit there and say, those cool nights in the Midwest, they're going to bring down what I consider my favorite season from up there, and that's that fall leaves. There's nothing like looking at that those sea of fall leaves out there in a forest. Yeah, I miss those.
I don't. I'm all about the summer these days, but what are you going to do? Yeah, there's just so short, but oh well. And with us too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing? And did you thought you knew everything?
Oh, I don't know.
I
got the point, you know. Pyramid, no. Pyramid pun. Yeah, I love the leaves too, until they fall off the tree. Then I got to rake them up. But it was 90 here in California today, in my section of California. So,
good Lord.
I think, yeah, fall has not really started. Actually, we get warmer weather in the fall here. A lot of cases.
Is that normal, 90 degrees?
Kind of. You know, we get an Indian summer, you know, or Native American summer, whatever is politically correct today.
I know it's hard to say anything in this age, is it?
Yeah, Commander's summer.
How about we go Hobbit with second summer?
There you go. I'll buy that for a dollar, as the other saying goes. So. Well, awesome. Well, yes, we will be discussing the Hall of Thoth. And as always, for those of you who are running into the comment sections on YouTube and Facebook, if you have questions as we do this presentation, please write them in all caps, all question marks, or do a super chat. And we will certainly do the best, our best, to get to thee. As for some house cleaning, as always, please support this show. Please support all independent podcasters. There was a scheduled show tomorrow at 12:30 with Danielle Dusky on the Season of the Witch. It was sort of another celebration of the fall equinox, but we will have to reschedule. Unfortunately, Danielle got the Rona. She's doing fine, but she did lose her voice, like Eve in the Gnostic Gospel. The Archon stole her voice. So we will have to reschedule. Other than that, Also, for those of you who are part of, who are AB Prime members and you are leveraging the private RSS feed, we will be changing the password on October 1st. So that's just a little alarm. So don't think when you're trying to stream full shows on AM Byte and it won't let you with your password, just go to the website and there will be a new password. Yes, for the season of The Witch, we've got some good shows coming in October. We got shows on the occult and national socialism. I'm sure a lot of people will be triggered. We got shows, philosophical shows on some Gnostic exemplars like Emile Cioran, David Lynch. We've got shows on time travel. We'll hopefully have a Halloween special of some sort. So we got some great shows coming up. So don't go anywhere. The Gnosis has just begun. It's raining Gnosis. Hallelujah. So other than that, I think that's all the house cleaning I have for now, or housekeeping. I always say house cleaning. Well, Grandpong, tell us about this discovery or what's in stall for us tonight.
Go ahead and bring it up, Miguel.
Bring it up right off the bat. All right, here I go.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was going to say that we can at least have the screen up for stuff.
You don't want warm up jokes or anything like that. My arms.
Oh, not for the. I was going to say not for the intro. The intro screen. We can tell the jokes over that one. That's much prettier than we are, in my opinion.
That is true. We are long in the tooth, the three of us. Well, great examples of the demiurge's promise in the world. The flesh is weak and it rots.
I stick by the saying, you know, I have to get old. I don't have to grow old.
I like that. Yeah. You're perfect.
You know.
Yeah. I was just in Portugal and, I think one of the things I admire is the elderly in Portugal. It's different than here in the United States. They are active. My aunt just turned 91, and she still takes the bus, walks miles a day, cleans her own house. Several of my uncles are in their 80s, and they're driving and taking trips. I mean, old people, it's almost a different mentality than here in the United States.
No, I agree. I was going to sit there and say, if you want to see old people active in America, you need to go to happy hour.
That is true. Awesome. Well, tell us about what we are looking now on the screen. Thoth Hall of Records.
Yeah, I figured I'd pull out, you know, Bill and Ted's TARDIS and dust that off and, you know, sort of go back to some old ideas of mine and kind of share with you some stuff that I think is sort of cool. And it's like, you know, it's I was reading a lot of this mythology and stuff early on. And it's one of those where I learned about, you know, building the pyramids when I was, I think, second grade. And when I was in my, you know, in my teens, I was sitting there and alternating between reading, you know, Eric Von Daniken, and to balance me off, I read a Hal Lindsey book to balance it off. Mm. You know, I figured between the two of them, you know, I should end up with science and math straight down the middle.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, but this is one I had where it's like, you know, I read about that one. And then, you know, as we get to the slides, read about, you know, started reading Casey about, and, you know, some of the new thought movement and all of that stuff in my, you know, in the early 70s. And that sort of like flipped a lot of my ideas on the pyramids and, you know, like an idea instantly, you know, a very sensible location as to where Thoth would have put his Hall of Records. You know, it just came to me. And again, this is like probably about 10, you know, I was 10 and I've yet to see any evidence that indicates it can't be there, so just wanted to share it with you and, you know, share some of my thought process and such. Have a good time tonight.
Let's have a good time. Awesome. Love this new stuff. Shall we go to slide 2?
Yep. Next slide.
Let me know how to.
I'll say next slide.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, I wanted to go a little bit into my methodology, and I sort of start from a, you know, Socrates is sort of your base when you're starting with any sort of epistemology or anything, right. You know, and he did the whole, you know, a doubt rather than knowledge at the base of epistemology, because everybody else was running around talking about what they knew. And he's like, well, I don't know this. And, you know, as I said there, I sort of paraphrase there from Lord of the Rings, you know, he was the one philosopher to bring them all in ignorance bind them. You know, and, you know, there's a part of me that's always been a little suspicious that Socrates saying that he knew nothing was sort of a humble brag. Because if you know nothing, by, you know, the converse, you know everything. And
mm-hmm.
it
makes sense. Yeah.
You know, and my last note is, you know, he wasn't part of the academy, but he kind of gets a pass since, you know, Plato didn't start the academy yet.
And that's that's a real picture of him, right? 2,500 years ago.
Of course.
Of course.
Or as of course, or as he's known as San Dimas, Socrates.
Yeah.
Next slide.
Next slide it is.
This is one of my intellectual heroes. This is Charles Sanders Peirce. And his quote is, you know, we cannot begin without complete doubt. And Aristotle formalized logic with deductive and inductive reasoning, you know, 2,000 years ago. What Peirce did was he sort of split the middle and combined the two and came up with abductive reasoning. It's like, you know, a lot of people say, you know, there are things with like mathematical proof. You have absolute certainty. And then you have, you know, your sensible stuff like the sun coming up every day. But that's not certain.
Right.
And Peirce, he very much formalized a way where you could basically probabilistic logic. You know, it's sort of like, as I sit there and say, me and LeBron James playing one-on-one. Yeah. People can say they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, but
let me bet. Give me 50-50 odds on LeBron and I will bet all day long. You know, and, you know, Peirce, for my money, is one of the most brilliant people ever. His writing is almost impenetrable to me until I already learn what he's talking about elsewhere. And then it's like, oh, that was what you were saying all along. He is just, but one of the things is nobody knows about him because he got blackballed by the academy. He got on the bad side of basically the president of Yale. And the person who really supported him was William James, the psychologist.
Oh, wow.
You know, and he basically supported him and, you know, fundraisers with his friends in Boston. And, you know, he never could. He ended up, you know, basically penniless when he died. Hmm. So, and it's, you know, but again, they haven't published all of his work yet. He's something else. And like I said, it's one of those, I go with the abductive reasoning because a lot of it is you're coming from more of that middle, I don't know place. And, you know, you got your rails of absolutely true, absolutely false on the side. And that plays is a different, you know, I've recognized that that's a different methodology that I use that I picked up from more of my STEM approach, you know, the math and the science stuff than a lot of more of the social science and, you know, literary approaches have. So next slide. This is the next philosopher in my chain. This is H.W. Jones Jr. He sort of took the Socrates and Peirce's and took it to the field. And yeah, his father like was doing, you know, world tours as a scholar, and he was advised by Jung when they met them in Europe in order to, you know, check in with Peirce because Peirce was working with semiotics and logic and could help him on his quest. And, you know, Jones Jr., he kind of took the philosophy and, you know, took it into action, much like, you know, Aristotle did with Alexander. Unfortunately, neither Alexander nor Jones Jr. wrote a lot of papers or books. You know, it goes with the territory. And he had a very, very heterodox relationship with the Academy.
Well, never heard of these figures. But
yeah, that's when he wasn't stunt doubling for Harrison Ford.
Exactly.
Yeah, for those listening in audio, is a very young and handsome Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. And
exactly, exactly.
For the record, I'm going to skip the next Indiana Jones movie.
I have to see it.
No, you do. Okay.
I've seen all the others. It's one of those. I've seen too many worse movies. I saw Batman and Robin.
Oh my God, so did I.
There's no way it's going to be worse than Batman and Robin. No way.
No, that is a good point. That is a good point. All right. Next slide, and hopefully it's not Batman and Robin, and it's not, thank God.
No. This is how I learned, you know, the evolution from Mastaba to the pyramid. And it's like the first burials in Egypt, they started as basically just covered pits. You dig the pit, put the stuff in, cover it up. And then they got more and more elaborate. You got, you know, better pits, better covers. You know, and eventually you got, you know, such deluxe pits and deluxe covers, and you had so much, you know, surplus, and you could hire a bunch of people to build them for you. That's when they started throwing in passages. So, and eventually, you know, the next step was to stack them on top of each other, and then you end up with a pyramid.
But you're saying that they brought the bodies down, right? Through a tunnel and then up into the structure?
Well, I'm saying this is how I was taught back in the 70s.
Okay.
And that was the explanation that it was there. They had to have the extra tunnels in order to get the bodies in, because they couldn't just build on top of the bodies anymore. Mm-hmm. Because they, you know, they were spending a lot more time building it. You know, and a lot more resources were going in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that one, and basically it's like the Giza complex and the Great Pyramid was the zenith of the whole pyramids building. Any questions at all yet, guys? Or
no, Vince, you good?
Okay.
Yep. All right. Okay, so far.
Okay, well, let's go next. And then along comes Casey. Then I read it, you know, after I read that one a few years later, then I read Casey. He was the sleeping prophet. And, you know, he channeled thousands of readings for free. I assume, yeah, you know, probably most of your listeners have at least some idea who he is. Mm-hmm. But he presented me an entirely different Egyptian chronology and different take on the whole thing. And he was the one who introduced, you know, the whole Hall of Records concept, and that this was, you know, to preserve the Atlantean knowledge, you know, for protect it until the end of time, basically. Next slide. Now, people have been looking for chambers in the pyramids since, you know, Caliph al-Mamun. He battered his hole in there, and then people started dealing in. You know, they found different niches, you know, the shafts out of the chambers and all that. And the most recent one, they did some muon detectors. They put him in the queen's chamber in order to, and they found a void, you know, I'm sure you know about the big void that they found above the Grand Gallery. And they also found a real small one, not too far from the entrance. Mm-hmm. Next slide. You know, what would Thoth do? So I figured that, you know, if I was my old big beak buddy Thoth, he wrote one Emerald Tablet, the other 13 were channeled. You know, where would I place my Hall of Records?
Right.
It's like, okay, because the pyramids are getting built much earlier in time. It's like, okay, I'm relocating the original Benben stone. It's going to the Temple of Ra in Heliopolis. Now I have a pit. Now I'm going to make that pit into my hall and just, you know, basically trip that up. And then I'm going to build the whole pyramid around the structure that, you know, basically go old school with you dig your pit and then you build the cover over top of it. You're just building a whole pyramid on top of it afterwards. And again, this has nothing really to do with the whole burial or tomb concept, since, you know, this is just sealing basically a chamber. Next slide. Here is what occurred to me. is going to be right about equidistance between the Queen's Chamber and the Subterranean Chamber. That then gives you basically almost an equidistance stack of four. It's like there's that huge void right at ground level. I'm saying that the pit was dug there. That's where the Hall of Records is. And you basically have almost solid granite for, what is it, 40, 50 feet. No passages. Because it was all built on top of it. And that was the best way to protect it. And yeah, that's the best I could come up with. And I figure, you know, heck, I'm a 10, 12-year-old kid. If I can come up with that, Thoth had to come up with at least that good or better, you know? Yeah, it's better than put it under the paw of the Sphinx where everybody traipses in and out.
Right. And for those who might be curious, what exactly is a Hall of Records for listeners?
That is, Casey introduced the idea that there were three Hall of Records that were basically established as Atlantis was falling in order to preserve the Atlantean records, Atlantean knowledge. And, you know, some of the artifacts. There was the one in Egypt, one in Mesoamerica, and then one in the Himalayas. And this was the Hall of Records that was established there, and that they were all going to basically be opened. That they were supposed to be stored and opened until the at the basically end of time, whatever that means. And however, apparently by the Casey readings, the one in Mesoamerica had been located and looted. Probably Spanish invaders. Yeah. Again, this is Casey channeling stuff. I can't be responsible.
So in words.
Yeah. So that's where I figure the location is. And there's no way the muon scan would have detected it because they set up in the Queen's Chamber above where... I would think the hall where the location I believe it is. If they had set it up in the subterranean chamber, you would have had data that would have showed something at least one way or the other. But nothing to show, you know, there's no solid evidence to show that it's not there. And it just seems a very sensible, logical place. Mm-hmm. Next slide.
Oh, hold on. Wrong one. Here you go.
Now, with those four chambers there, you now have some new possibilities for interpretation of the pyramid. It could be with, you know, four is the number on the top of the jet. The pyramid now could be functioning something, you know, a la, you know, sitting on top, but like a jet pillar. It also, if you look at the next one, some sort of fractionating column for refining. If you look at the, the Grand Gallery and a lot of the other ones, it doesn't look that dissimilar to some sort of, you know, refining fractionating situation. And the last possibility that it opens up, given that you have, you know, what is it, you know, dozens of feet of granite, it could be something along the lines of, you know, Krishna's heart, sort of an arc reactor sort of thing. That was also part of powering the pyramid back in the day, but it's sealed in there, sort of, you know, radiation protection and everything else. Again, all of these are huge speculations on top of an already speculative location. But just, you know, it's interesting that the possibilities.
Very cool.
Next slide. And that's my ending. The Wild Stallion's Gospel, both chapters, be excellent to each other, and party on, dudes.
Ah, that's where you got it. That's where you got it. I knew he looked familiar.
Exactly.
Well, that was a short and concise presentation. I'm sure we can talk about a lot, about much more. My question for the audience that might want to know, what was Casey's vision of the fall of Atlantis? What was his take on it that differs from Plato and others?
I'm not that familiar on Casey in order to be that authoritative on it. What I've read as far as, you know, with the pyramid goes, it seems like it was more calculated and intentional than an accident in Casey's one. It's like a sort of a pre-planned collapse disaster. Yeah, that was sort of the take I did in order to, and that's why you had the halls of records and everything in order to rebuild afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And he had it right over the Sahara. Is that where he had Atlantis or where he claimed it was?
No, Casey was the one with the Bahamas and the Mediterranean. The
Bahamas, okay.
Yeah, yeah. He had it where there was basically the Sargasso Sea area that subsided and sunk right about then. That's where Casey had his Atlantis at. And I'm of the take is there were many Atlantises. Many Atlantises, that many of them sunk at different points in time. It's a cyclical kind of thing.
It was an empire. And for the audience, Grandpom talks about it in our last interview on Homo Divinus and Atlantis, so where you sort of reconstruct this timeline and Atlantis is in it. And yeah, as Terrence McKenna says, Rome falls 9 times an hour. I'm sure Atlantis is falling 9 times an hour too.
But has Rome fallen?
Well, there you go. Philip K. would argue with that because the empire never ended. So.
I was going to say, never argue with Phil.
No. Definitely not. If not, those three-eyed Christians will come and get you. Vince, what do you think? Do you have a question or a question from the audience?
We had one question. Mark Jefferson wanted to know if Thoth had any corresponding identity in the Nordic, you know, among in the North, which god would he correspond to?
That's one of those sticky questions, because once you get up into the Norse areas, there's not an interpreto that works really, really well. It's like it's easy to go from Naboo to Thoth to Hermes, Mercury. Those are very consistent, but it's almost like in the Norse, Thoth gets split between Odin and kind of Loki.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I've always had trouble with the interpretation of Hermes as Odin. It always seemed like Loki was a much better fit for him, in my opinion. Now, I don't know about what you guys think there.
Yeah, but a lot of the symbolism and other things does lean again more towards Odin. So, yeah, I would certainly agree that it's split. Probably gets more complicated when you get into just the continental, the mainland or Germanic, because I think Loki is specific to Scandinavia. He doesn't really appear in Germanic lore and all that so.
Oh, I didn't know he didn't make it much into the mainland. You know, I assume past Denmark. He must add something in Denmark, because that's basically Scandinavian.
Right.
No, it's one of those. It's more of the portfolios of the gods. It's like the portfolios kind of get split differently up north, and my guess is a lot of that is the colder weather and such. They have different priorities, so that they end up splitting hairs slightly differently.
I never thought their society was very intellectual. Anyway, I mean, Thoth was very huge knowledge, and so forth, a kind of a source of knowledge, whereas I never thought any of the Nordic gods really, they were more like fighting, and swords and Asgard and all this other stuff. That's always my impression. Maybe that's kind of ignorant, but that was my impression.
No, you got 90% of them. There's only a couple of them that weren't, and it's sort of like, Odin was one with I'm going to hang on the tree for 7 days in order to figure out the runes. Loki was always the schemer. He was always Yeah, he was definitely not he was the one, again, you know, from the Marvel stuff. He was always the, you know, writing checks he didn't have enough in his account to cover. And, yeah. You know, a lot of times he was able to, get it into the bank before the check hit. And if he didn't, that's where you get, Sletnir from.
Yeah, scheming as opposed to, investigating the knowledge of the universe.
Well, I was going to say it's scheming, but if you look at all of the stuff that the Norse gods have, other than the stuff with Odin, it all came from Loki. Thor's hammer was that one. The walls of Asgard. The walls of Asgard was he got them for free because he bet the one giant, and that's where Sleipnir came from. He basically tricked the giant's horse so the giant couldn't finish it on time. And the meat of poetry was. It's one of those where Thor's kind of adult, but
Well, it's again the trickster archetype. They're the ones who bring the knowledge and the gifts to humanity. I know Thoth really isn't much of a trickster, but then, of course, once he transformed into Mercury or Hermes, you've got that trickster idea. But yeah, the trickster is the one who brings fire to both the gods and the humans.
I was going to say, if you're looking at, back in the... Sumerian, Babylonian, you got Nabu being the son of an Enki, kind of runs in the family.
Yeah, and for the audience, bringing up movies again, don't waste your time watching Thor Love and Thunder. It was just shit. The only good thing about that movie was the screaming goats, and the rest of the movie was just dreadful. Have you guys watched it?
No.
I haven't yet. Ugh.
So you're saying painful. the goats didn't scream long enough for you?
You wanted them to scream longer.
Yeah, that was the best. They were the best part of the movie. Drown out the horrible plot and writing and wasted opportunities with comic book narrations that just got butchered and destroyed. It was a disaster.
Did they disrespect Thor?
No Loki at all. Yeah, they disrespect Thor. No Loki. It was just...
That one, it had a feeling of a little bit too woke for my taste of being able to be that good of a movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't even go that far. I mean, again, the worst thing was the writing and the plot line. And that was least of your worries. The least of the pain would be the wokeness.
Was it the trying to fit too many comic book plots and stories into one movie?
Yeah, and trying to make them all comedies, not having enough time for some serious, pathos, if you would. Too much slapstick, especially with serious. The comic book narrations that they have were pretty serious stuff, and this one they try to make it into some sort of a slapstick, tongue in cheek stuff. It was just disastrous.
Well, they were able to make it work with Guardians, mm-hmm. I guess, and they've been trying to fit Thor into Guardians. And I think that might be kind of what they're trying to do here. But again, they could have done it a heck of a lot better, sounds like.
1,000 times better. And yeah, and I mean, I know spoilers is... the Guardians only appear like the first 10% of the film, and then it's just Thor being a big doofus throughout the rest of the film. Tessa Thompson has one expression throughout the whole film, and oh my God, it's just painful, painful.
So they're going back to the old comic book routine of guest starring the Guardians of the Galaxy for 3 pages.
Batman and Robin meet. No, is it Scooby-Doo meets Batman and Robin? Scooby-Doo meets Kiss. Remember those days?
Oh, yeah. No. They actually did a series not too long ago where they brought back a lot of that, where they had, because they bought DC bought the rights to Scooby-Doo and Warner Brothers. So they were teaming him up with the superheroes again in the comics. It was, as long as it's all fun.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, here's a question as I'm looking. Emmanuel Wolf wants to know, is it true there is a craft under the Sphinx?
Like an alien craft, right? Is that what he means?
Yeah, no. This one, yeah, it's would not surprise me if there was the remains of a crash under there that they built over top of. Kind of similar to you know, the rumors that you have in Antarctica and such.
Oh, you know, that's a big one.
You know, I could see that have happened, that, you know, you had crashes there a long time ago, and there's a ship there, and that's part of their underground complex and such.
Who's they? The Nazis? I'm going back to the Nazis no matter what tonight. That's all there is to it.
I was going to say it's before the Nazis. It's like you said, it's one of those. Homo divinus and such is my go-to. They're an easy answer. You know, again, I sit there. It's one of the things that once I had that, you know, that sort of the principle when I'm reading through stuff and I'm reading the, you know, like how Thoth became associated with as a baboon. And that's because baboons were considered a wise animal. Mm-hmm. Baboons were used by the priests in the temples because the baboons were more responsible than the humans.
Really?
Yeah. Think about that for a second. The humans aren't as responsible as the baboons. Who are the priests? They're clearly more responsible than the baboons.
Yeah.
So they're not human, you know. Yeah. Oh. Chain of logic. Yeah, it's that's one of those where, yeah, you know, if the humans aren't even capable of just working in the temple, odds are the people running the temple are several steps higher. Again, just going off of just the stories and logic.
I'd pay to see a bunch of baboons, you know, straightening up the temple, you know, moving the jars back and forth, lining them up, things like that. That'd be good.
I was going to say you had that little monkey in the Raiders of the Lost Ark that got poisoned by the date. Mm-hmm. He was pretty competent.
Yeah, that is true. Going back to Raiders of the Lost Ark again. And the Nazis. They were important in number one and number three.
Hey, we had another question, by the way, about Thoth. And Mercenary wants to know what we think of Blake Lemoyne wanting to train the AI Lambda to become Thoth.
Huh.
In other words,
That's the first I've heard of that. Now,
tell you what I think of it. It's like, how could you train an AI to be something more than what you are? I mean, you could read a bunch of books into it or whatever, but how could it actually be Thoth? You know what I mean?
Well, the concept there is the AI emergent or not? And if it's emergent, it can exceed, you know, it's initial programming and its initial programmer. And I don't know if you could get an AI to do something like it. It's like computers are different than people, and it's like people are drawing off of cells. And I don't know how computers could have feelings, or, you know, it's like it's tough to sit there and try to understand for me just how it works. It's like, and I know AIs are amazing. It's like I was at the first Gecko conference in 99. That's a genetic and evolutionary computing.
Yeah, I think I'm agree with you and Phil too, Philip K. Dick, that AI is never going to happen. Machines will never be conscious. Just not going to happen. Although the argument would be, if you wanted to take an idealist position, that if consciousness is basically an energy and we are sort of the antennas, like animals are the antennas, and we draw different pieces of consciousness, then why couldn't a machine trap that wave of consciousness that permeates the universe? So I don't know. I don't think it can. What do you think? But some people are saying, well, look at quantum computer. Quantum computer is going to produce consciousness. Do you guys have thoughts on this? Because I know nothing about quantum computing.
I say it's going to be a combination of the two. It's when your neural nets and your AI get crossed with your quantum computing. Because the quantum computing is going to bring in that uncertainty that you need for free will and volition. And that's what you need for actual consciousness. The neural nets will give it the framework in which to act out its free will and consciousness. Kind of like our physical bodies allow us to exert our free will and consciousness. It's just going to be a little different. That's my thought.
Yeah, my thought is quantum computing is different than digital computing because it can be indeterminate. It can come up with, you know, it can kind of run parallel things at once. So it would probably be good to speed up perception. But what an AI needs is, first of all, it needs to build a model of the universe and a model of itself. It needs a connection to the universe of some sort. And, you know, human beings have connections to the universe, you know, consisting of the senses. But many of us believe that we have more than just, the, you know, sensory connections to the universe, that there's a spiritual connection. And I think that's where it starts to fall, you know, fall apart. Any mechanical contrivance would have to be able to tune in, so to speak, to whatever information source goes beyond, you know, light, matter, and so forth, whatever spirit's made of. Yeah, Graham, what? Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I would agree with you, Vance, and that's exactly where the quantum would come in. It is pulling from that beyond, you know, that beyond, you know, light and time, space sort of realm. That's why, you know, the physicists have had such problems dealing with it.
Yeah, non-locality, right? You know, in the quantum world, you know, location really doesn't mean much. I mean, it's kind of probabilistic, you know, as far as what's where. It's probably here.
And that ties back to my presentation with Charles Peirce, that's what he was dealing with, is that level of just, it starts with uncertainty. And, you know, that certainty is like islands within seas of uncertainty. Certain yes, certain no's are like seas within probabilistic. You know, and that's very close to like how the quantum goes. And that's why, you know, like I said, I'm a big fan of Peirce. I use a lot of his ideas. He starts from a different base, I do, but, you know, or maybe he doesn't. I don't know. I don't understand enough, I guess. I throw up my hands.
Yeah, at some point.
Oh, there's some people you just can't. It's like Jung, man. How many pages are left to be unpublished to be read? You know. And that's true. Not even counting all the 10,000 that have been published.
And also, most people don't know he's got that series of interviews. I forgot the name of it, but you guys have seen on YouTube where he's like, you know, I don't believe in God. I know God. I know. And, you know, there's these cool, like, cool clips of Jung that you can find on YouTube talking about consciousness and all that. But that's a series of these sort of unplugged interviews he did. And there's hours of it and still hasn't made it to the public. So even with Jung, there's still a lot of stuff that's out there. So.
Very cool. I haven't seen all of them. I've only seen a couple of the interviews. It's like when I saw the Red Book, the first time I flipped through it, and it's like, man, he was a frustrated comic book writer artist.
Good point. He would have been very happy in the 70s with Moore and all these other. I was thinking
Mobius. The first time I flipped through his Mandelas, I was thinking of Mobius's horny goof, if you've ever seen that, with the way it melts page to page. And it's like, damn, man, you were like 70 years ahead of him.
Exactly. And yeah, for the audience, we want to do a future show on comic books and pop culture, but just to whet their appetite, if you had to provide a list of top five hermetic and or Gnostic comic books, Graham, what would be your list? And you've given me some suggestions which have just been awesome.
Yeah, no, the last one that I suggested to you is right there. It's one of the masterpieces of the industry, and that's Planetary by Warren Ellis and John Cassidy. It was awesome. They managed to keep the same creative team together for it took them, I think it was 6 or 7 years to get the whole series out. You know, normally you throw in, you know, fill-in writers or, you know, fill-in creators, but that they allowed the people to tell their story, and it ended up working. And that one's up there. So much by Moore. I mean, obviously V for Vendetta. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to say which one by Moore isn't necessarily Gnostic.
For me, ironically, his most obvious hermetic or Egyptian mystery one, Promethea, I think is some of his weakest writing. It's like he was trying to force it. I don't know. It's good, but it's nothing as moving as other.
There's a lot that Moore was doing that was similar to what Ellis was doing in Planetary, where they were changing the different art styles from issue to issue. Right. It's for me, I love J.H. Williams III's art just so much. You know, I really don't care who's writing it. The fact that it was Alan Moore, just, you know, it was a bonus, even if it wasn't his best. And for me, I loved his Armageddon at the end of the series. It worked so well with the way he did that one with, you know, interplaying with Tom Strong and this whole, you know, ABC universe. And we should do an episode just on Moore because there's so much about Moore that people just, they don't know, don't understand.
Let's do it. A show on Moore. Yeah. And I guess for comic books, I would say we've talked, yeah, Grant Morrison, obviously The Invisibles is the great Gnostic treatise, and what's it in? Multiversity is pretty good.
Yeah, no, Invisibles is solid, that one. That one, a lot of that got cribbed for The Matrix, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah. It's obvious.
That's why Grant was so pissed about that. That's why he left DC at that point in time. They had the Invisibles comics on the set, and the Wachowskis came from the comic industry previously. You know, that's where they started the writing, and it's just now he was not happy about that. Powers is surprisingly Gnostic in the comic series. Yeah, it was a TV series briefly, but that's another Warren Ellis one where it's you know, police officer in a city of superheroes. And I'm trying to think what else. I'm trying to think some of the off the beaten path kind of things. I was going to say Gaiman. It's been a while since Gaiman wrote too much. I mean, Sandman Overture, he's overdue on Miracle Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know in the Sandman, Gaiman does mention the Canaanites, and he calls them a Gnostic sect that, you know, that followed Cain and did all these, they were libertine and all that. That shows up in Seasons of the Mist, and it's actually Satan who's talking about this Gnostic sect. And he says that they sent less people to hell than other religions, which he thought was funny. Gaiman, I think his Gnostic opus would probably have to be Coraline. It's my favorite children's story.
No, Coraline, that's nice. I was going to say, I don't know if you ever read his Grail short story. No, that one I always enjoyed. No, that's worth a read. No, he has it, again. What I like with Gaiman, he's, for my money, he is just a master of the craft. You know, I don't know if you ever read the Miracle Man series at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that highlights the difference between Moore and Gaiman. Because in like Moore's last issue, he had, you know, he had like one throwaway balloon, one sentence, and Gaiman would take that one sentence and turn that into an entire issue. And then he put all those issues into a series. And it's like, yeah, he can take anything and turn it into a well-crafted story. You know, Moore's a combination of it. It's like Morrison early on, he was just running on just raw, you know, just raw fumes, don't know what he's doing. You know, he's breaking rules, but it works because he doesn't know what he's doing. It's like that. You can see how he matured on Animal Man. I assume you've read that one through. And that, I was going to say, that one has he started with one book and he ended with a different one. And it was he and it all was much better for that. Trying to see what else I'm thinking of. I would say surprisingly, Runaways would have a certain amount of that dualistic back and forth leveling, you know. Because you have, you know, the parents are the villains, so the kids become, you know, the heroes. I don't know. What are some of your favorite ones, Miguel?
I think you just mentioned all of them. I think, as far as a Gnostic theme, those would be the one. For just in general, well, there's a whole bunch of them.
I mean, I was going to say, in the superheroes, there's a lot of stuff that got embedded back in the Marvels. It's like, you know, the Thing has a certain about a Gnostic thing with, you know, the stuck in there. You know, it's
Yeah, and then of course you have like there's a villain called Abraxas and one in Marvel. It gets thrown in there. It's like Dungeons and Dragons. You know, Gary Gygax was just throwing everything in the kitchen sink and creating all this syncretic, this wonderful syncretic stew of stuff.
I was gonna say there's probably more esoteric stuff in Dungeons and Dragons than almost anywhere else.
Yeah, and it always cracks me up because Gary Gygax was a Jehovah's Witness. So,
I did not know that.
Yeah, he was.
So was Prince. I knew that.
Mm-hmm. Prince was too, and one of the great underrated guitar players of all history. The man could play guitar better than almost anybody.
Oh, that's. I sat there and said when he died, it's like he was the greatest overall package we will ever see. Agreed. Between writing, singing, performing, the instruments, the engineering on the records, you know, the thumbing your nose at the record industry, the whole thing.
Oh yeah, genius in every way. So, but here we are. Well, Vince, any questions on Egypt or Thoth or anything else? I know we've kind of gone on a tangent, but, you know, it's the first day. It's a fall equinox, first day of spring, so we wanted to break some rules.
Did the Egyptians have comic books? Take a long time to write them, though.
we're still reading them. They're on the walls.
Right.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that's from like Scott McCloud's, you know, Understanding Comics. He goes, as comics are basically, it's sequential art that tells a story. Yeah. That's so much what the ancient Egyptians had. You know, they had the first comic books.
There you go. Good answer. Good answer. Oswald Spengler, a frequent visitor to Aeon Byte Live, wanted to know, if you could comment, Graham, on both the Eye and the Aeon of Horus and Thoth's Emerald Tablet in relation to what we're talking about tonight. What do you think about the Emerald Tablet? What about the Eye of Horus? What about the Aeon of Horus? That sounds like a Crowley kind of thing.
I'm not sure about what the Aeon of Horus is. That's the first I've heard of that one.
No, that's Crowley, remember? He was bringing about the Aeon of Horus during his little sex magic thing in Egypt.
No, it's Crowley. Crowley's such an interesting character. Well, he's like with Zachariah Sitchin. There's so much that's, you know, to be admired about a lot of their approaches. And then it's like they're going down the road and all of a sudden they put their car in the lake. And it's like, you didn't need to do that. Yeah. So with the Eye of Horus, you know, I haven't looked at any drawings, but again, just picturing off the top of my head, I could imagine that one of those, because the Eye of Horus often is overlaid with the brain and, you know, things like that, where it corresponds with the pineal gland. I could easily picture just picturing it in my head where some sort of diagram that puts where I see the Hall of Records within the pyramid would be roughly where the Eye of Horus might be. Again, depending on how you do your geometry, but that's one of the problems that I have with it is there's so many different ways you can set it up, and it's almost like you're ending with pareidolia, where it's like as soon as you find some numbers that kind of start to line up, then you start going with it, and it's like I like it better when the numbers happen to line up after the fact, and they're more verification and, you know, for me. But there's some people doing some really, really good stuff on the Great Pyramid these days.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Oh, I don't know them off the top of my head. I saw one recently where they were breaking everything down into Fibonacci numbers. And they were basically saying, and it's the idea that the pyramid was built using a slightly different mathematics, using a slightly different numbers. And with the math I know, what they were saying made a lot of sense. You know, they definitely sounded like they were onto something. As they kept saying, it's like they had their theory and they kept looking more and more and it kept lining up more and more. And that's always a good sign. I was going to say.
Has anybody come up with a good, you know, timeline? You know, you've seen those predictive timelines where you map on the time, you know, starting from the entrance of the pyramid and it goes up the corridor, and you know, this place corresponds to 1900 and this corresponds to World War One. And is that all over, or is somebody still trying to do that? You know.
Oh, I'm sure there are a bunch of people trying to do that. That's, you know, again, where they some of them reconciling with Book of Daniel and, you know, that situation. It's, I don't know. Again, it's one of those. It's, I'm dubious, you know. Anytime that it's so easy to read stuff in. And that's one of those one things that we know for certain about, you know, doomsday prophecies. Yes. Everyone has been wrong so far. You know, and that's why when you're starting your basis off, I'm assuming that there's a doomsday. And you know, again, I'm not saying that I don't know, but you're kind of starting from what looks like a flawed assumption from my standpoint. And it's easy to lead yourself into error.
Yeah, but it moves books and it makes money. I mean, right now the ocean should be covering most of the country. Y2K, the Mayan one. I mean, they do move books. Yeah, Vince, we need to come with our own Gnostic doomsday scenario. Make some money off of that. Yeah.
Have to think about that one.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I always had a short story that I wrote back in grade school on that one. That was back in the days of the Omen and stuff. And I sat there and said that the second coming of Jesus was basically that all of the relics that are in the altars and everywhere were just all of a sudden going to like congeal together and like become, you know, the super holy. Yeah, trust me, the nun didn't like that too much, the story. But it was like a zombie Jesus, made Frankenstein Jesus of all the, you know, relics from all the churches in the world and such.
That's pretty creative.
Yeah, I like that.
I got one. We'll have an AI that somebody gets a super smart AI that tries to train it to be the demiurge, and then it actually becomes the demiurge. See, you know, and he does it under the pyramid. He's got a secret lab under the pyramid. Tie that in there.
You're getting too close to the stuff I've heard already, man.
Yeah, too close to the truth, Vance. We'll have to eliminate you.
Oh, no, Klaus Schwab is after me now.
I mean, one of my favorite ones is, you know, it's the Yahweh is a... is the AI computer that's capable of basically projecting backwards in time. And pretty much that's the whole thing is, you know, he's trying to bring about his being, and that's what all the, you know, telling Moses what to do and all the prophets is all, kick him here, nudge him there in order to bring himself into existence. And again, that idea has been around for decades.
It's like that movie Memento, but for Yahweh. Is that kind of it? Well, let me ask you this, Graham, two questions. Why do you think humans have such a fascination with ancient Egypt more than any other ancient empire? There were other empires. There was a lot of fascinating monuments, but Egypt really captures the attention of Western men.
My gut reaction is it's the hats. The Egyptians had better hats than anyone else. And you got to respect a hat, a good hat, you know.
Yeah.
But getting serious.
The friggin' cap is kind of gay. You're right. All these other hats kind of suck. You're right.
I won't say that it looks like a used condom, you know.
They're aliens.
Or Nazis. We're going back to Nazis. They're actually Nazis.
You got to have your pick. The Nazis didn't have they didn't have those extended heads.
Yeah,
that's, and again, that could be a reason for the good hats in Egypt. They wanted to look like the big head people. No. The reason I think it was one of the earliest civilizations. I'm not sure what the whole relationship between Egypt, Sumer, and India is. I'm willing to sit there and say India probably actually does some predating Egypt and Sumer. And they got started sort of after the Mahabharata War, if I said that even close to right. after that one. And that's when Egypt, Sumer, and all that one was the next, restart after that. And then again, that's, go ahead.
They left so much behind. That's one of the things that I think tracks people. I mean, the pyramids, what's around that's anything like the pyramids? The temples, the mystery of it. And the pretty pictures on the walls.
Well, that's what I always love about Ancient Aliens is they always go to those awesome places. And I'll sit there and say, I can't say that a lot of the stuff in Peru is that far behind the stuff in Egypt with, the stuff Machu Picchu and Pumapunku and Sacsayhuamán, all of that stuff down there. And that's part of what we're talking about the global civilization. If you look at the polygonal, masonry that's at the base of a lot of the walls in a lot of the places.
Did they leave behind a lot of writing? The people down in Machu Picchu, Peru, and, the South American, Mesoamerican, because that's the difference that I always noted, that the Egyptians left a lot of symbolic writing behind.
But better comic books.
Yeah. The other civilizations didn't really tell us as much about themselves.
Well, you have to remember how much got destroyed of the Mayans and the Aztecs, intentionally destroyed to make sure nobody knew about their history.
And the Incas.
The Incas are a slightly different story because the Incas, their way of communicating wasn't with written words. They had their quipus, which were basically like knotted strings, where it's like different threads, different knots. You know, there was a very, it was a very complex code that they used to communicate, and that's, you know, that's what they used instead. Now, the biggest thing with the writing is one of the things that I pieced together with the Homo Divinus stuff is the writing ties. I don't know if we talked about this last time, Miguel, but the writing, the onset of writing ties in with the elongated skulls going away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, we didn't talk about that.
Yeah, no. And the reason I realized for that one is they didn't need writing because they could remember from their previous lives.
Mm.
If they learned it in one life, they knew it in the next one. No. So there was no need to write anything down. And now you're talking about, you know, what happened with, you know, the whole drinking from the, you know, the river of Leth, and, you know, where people don't remember their past lives now.
Right.
You know, and how about that telepathy?
Maybe they were telepathic. Then you wouldn't need writing either.
Oh, there was probably something like that. Again, I don't know how true it was. You had like Madame Blavatsky and, you know, telepathically communicating with the masters in Tibet. I don't know. All that channel theosophy stuff is interesting. Grains of salt.
Yeah. And briefly before we go, could you give a little summary of Homo Divinus, as you've mentioned it a few times, and there might be some people in the chat and the audience who, how dare they might have missed our last interview.
Oh, I thought everybody sees all your shows, Miguel.
Yeah.
See how wrong I am about stuff?
Yeah, you're finally wrong about something, man.
Now, Homo Divinus, I started writing about that in 2019, and that's where I had worked through from a very naturalistic basis, and I basically came to the conclusion from facts and logic that the gods and all of that one, there was a previous intelligent hominid species that developed in Southeast Asia / Australia before the sea level rose, because we know that Homo erectus had gotten down there over a million years ago. We know they were seafaring. We know they got to the islands and became Florensis and all of those. But what happened is we have basically no records after about a million years ago with Peking man. And the bones of that one are very, very, the story behind those bones are very interesting. You know, cloak and dagger, people getting bribes, meet at the top of the Empire State Building sort of stuff. It's interesting to look into. But it's the idea of, we know what happened to the Homo erectus that stayed in Africa. They became Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. We don't know what happened to the ones that were in basically the same sort of, you know, jungle climate, everything else in Southeast Asia, down there. No idea. And all of the myths and stories talk about, you know, them coming from the east, you know, coming from the water. And if you have, you know, a seafaring based, you know, based nation there. And the idea is those were the became intelligent before Homo sapiens. And they basically became a spacefaring hominid over 500,000 years ago. So it's sort of like the ancient astronaut theory I get behind. Not aliens. They were hominids that left Earth, and they happened to wear spacesuits just like people do these days. Just, you know, a long time ago. Think that about, you know, I was going to say, any other questions you have in order to give people a, based on that? I was going to say the other one is I found the impact crater in Antarctica, but, you know, that set me on the way.
Oh, wow. Well, I wanted to mention in our last interview for the audience, check it out. I think it was March. came out. I'll put it on the show notes for those listening on audio. But it's fascinating because in our interview, you talked about how the Georgia Guidestones might have been a signal to some of the Homo Divinus that's out there on space exploring. And they came back and they're like, okay, this is how we run this world when we have to run this world. And you know what happened between our last interviews, Graham? Something happened to the Georgia Guidestones. What are your feelings on this? Somebody bombed the shit out of them.
I first heard that on your show. Yeah, I was watching your show when you broke it not too long after. I was like, what the hell?
faction of Homo Divinus, or who did it?
There's something really fishy about it on so many different levels. It's like there was, you know, you plow it over hours later. There's no real investigation into, you know, IED, the timing of when stuff went off. It just, I mean, I had been there March 2021.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's not a place of ancient power. Just didn't have the ancient power feel. But it was definitely picking up some new power feel from again, as people investing in it and interesting in it. You know, it's, I don't know why people would blow it up.
2021, and you left a time bomb there in March? No, just joking.
I hope not. I was going to say.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope us talking about it didn't get it blown up. It's like, know that was that. I wrote a snippet on it, and that was the one that got me the biggest amount of hassles from people.
Really? Why?
Part of it is, one, I kicked myself because I tried to make a rule of cutting off at just past World War II. Because sort of in the Secrecy Act, you don't want to be talking about stuff people alive are necessarily involved in.
Right.
You know, and it's like people on both sides of the aisle are obsessed with it, both on the Freemason side and on the anti-Freemason side. And it's like, you know, it's like critical theory, regardless of what position you take. The somebody shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's again, I used to be able to get along okay discussing politics with people because I just sort of feel them out and find out, oh, you hate Trump? Here's my list. It's even longer than your list of reasons to hate Trump. Now, if somebody else came up and said Biden, I'd have a longer list than they had for Biden too. Mm-hmm. I hate both of them equally. As I sat there and said, I stood in line for an hour to fill in a ballot with neither of them filled in for president because I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to be choosing. You know, which septuagenarian billionaire was going to get to, unfairly reward, you know, his family and friends over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it seemed like to me. And if that's what it was, I don't need to weigh in on that one. They can everybody else can decide who gets to do that without me.
Yeah, I'm out of the voting thing. I am done. People are still very invested in the Georgia Guidestones on both sides. It's amazing how this really struck a chord, might be by design. And what's fascinating too is this October 1st, it's going to be 5 years since the Vegas shooter for that Harvest Festival. And like you said, with the Guidestones, we know nothing. We still know absolutely nothing. It was obviously some sort of ritual, but that's as far as I can tell it is.
You mean to blow it up? Was a ritual or
building? No, the Vegas shooting. The Vegas shooting. Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah, I agree with you. It was a ritual. I'm also suspicious it was a botched assassination. That there was somebody there that I'm pretty sure I'm not going to mention that got tipped off and ended up not being there. So what happened happened. I was going to say, on the Georgia Guidestones, that's one of those. I was actually able to track down who built them.
Really?
Yeah. And that's one of those things I don't tell people because, yeah, I got to have some respect for the people. But it was pretty much, it was a Rosicrucian.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And again, I don't have a problem against any of the people. Just don't go around hurting people. That's my rule.
Yeah.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah, it's like growing up. It's, you know, as I sit there and say, you know, I joke. I grew up a young goy in a primarily Jewish community, and you know, I probably learned more Hebrew with flashcards with my than some of my classmates when I was training for the bar mitzvahs. You know, but it's one of those we, you know, sit there and used to say. It's like it was actually kind of a, you know, subject of pride. That's like, you know, sit there and say. Yeah, do you know Jewish people control Hollywood? Well, yeah. Sit there and add up the shares of stock. The people who own the most shares of stock control it. You know, who's on the board of directors? You know, and as they sat there and said, sitting there and saying the Jews do it, that's not anti-Semitic. Was, you know, if you sit there and say, you know, the person's in charge doing something, if they're an asshole, now. You should be against them because they're an asshole, not because they're Jewish. Not all Jews are, you know, and that's the thing, isn't it? That's what they all agreed is, you know, you object to the person because of what they're doing, not because of who they are.
Exactly.
You know, and again, I find it, you know, I'm not sure if that I think that attitude's changed over the years. I think there's too much outrage culture these days.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, agreed. It's completely out of control.
Well, I think they're going to make a new version of the Georgia Guidestones. They're just going to have one big tablet that said, you will own nothing and you will be happy. Big stone.
Eat bugs, live in a pond. Right.
I was going to say, I always liked my zeroth commandment. Do as God says, not as God does.
Yaldabaoth will be proud of you. The Demiurge speaketh. He is proud.
Lord only knows. I was going to say too much critical theory, too much hate. You know.
Yeah, not enough dialogue. I mean, that's why on this show I have no problem having people who are antagonistic towards Gnosticism or Hermeticism or the occult. It's great to have a conversation and exchange ideas and see what their perspective is and learn new things. I have no problem at all.
No, conversation is 100% the key there. I hate debates because debates is like I'm holding up a target and I'm trying to move it around so you can't hit it. And I'm trying to shoot your target that you're holding up. And it's like at the end of it, the only thing I learned as far as truth goes is, you know, what hole somebody shot in the other person's target. I can't be sure if whatever's left standing is true. Mm-hmm. Because, again, it's the whole, I don't know if it's true. You're just trying to say it's better than what the other guy is. And now again, we're back to the you know, Trump, you know, Biden, Trump.
Well, they're just reflections of what this country's what's happened to this country. They are. Trump was the American dream come true, the extroverted, bombastic, materialist, show business kind of egregore, if you would. He certainly was the trickster spirit moving through him. And Biden is sort of this golem, half asleep, disoriented kind of. Again, egregore, which is what the American public has become after. Just can't see through the fog of anything. We were just talking about no dialogue. Nobody's listening. Everybody's just sort of, regressing into some sort of childhood aspect. Senile, like old people turn more into children. So, Biden, Trump. Trump, Biden are a reflection. They are our egregores. They are our shadows. They are our projections. So we want something better, then we as a people have to look inward and we have to walk the walk and express better thoughts and have better dialogue. So I don't want to get on a tangent, but here we are.
No, I agree.
And it's the Nazis' fault.
The thought that occurred to me is whatever, you got Trump and Biden, whatever happened to, Redford and Newman? Because, again, those were actually decent human beings, despite being in Hollywood. Redford was married to his wife the whole time. Newman, same thing. And all the money that they gave away, the Sundance Festival, that's not what I'm seeing in the current crop.
No. But I wonder, did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kiss survive at the end of the movie? I still think about it at night in bed.
Well, and the actual story? I mean, in the movie, it freezes.
Right, it freezes, yeah.
No, but in the actual story, they get slaughtered.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I know now after all of it, 40 years. Next you'll tell me Tony Soprano died at the end of the show. Next you'll tell me this, huh?
No, I can sit there and tell you he had a stroke and, he doesn't remember anything now.
He became the president of the United States now. Just sort of out of it.
One thing, like Anchorman with Biden, Rick.
Oh, God. Yeah, Biden must be an Alan Moore fan because he was auditioning for the dictator in V for Vendetta.
Oh, dear Lord.
The Dark Brandon, right?
I only wish Biden was that smart. It's like, I honestly go back and forth. Is Biden more senile coming in than Reagan was going out?
Yeah, I think, good point. That's a good thing to consider. Both are certainly out of it. And Biden was never, he was always just a weasel. He was never popular. He lost every time he was running for president. He was always part of the neocon, neoliberal establishment, big for big pharma and the military industrial complex. So he was just basically shoehorned. I mean, even the people don't have a choice anymore. That's how bad it is.
Well, Biden had reached the point is it was his turn. They didn't. They couldn't. It was either going to be him or Hillary, and they just couldn't stomach running Hillary again. It's just, I was going to say on Biden. It's
Bernie Sanders was probably the most, he should have been the nominee.
Bernie, his ideas, I'm not sure they're scalable much above about a 10,000 person city. I don't think they're going to work on a nationwide level. I like Bernie a lot, but I was going to say, getting back to Biden, if you remember why Biden had to drop out of the 92 presidential race, it's because he had plagiarized the convention speech.
Right.
And what he had plagiarized is he had plagiarized Neil Kinnock's childhood and was passing it off as Joe Biden's childhood.
That's terrible.
And it's like,
you were forgiven.
Somebody plagiarism forgave. Is one thing, but that's sort of a. Do you have nothing that's real in Joe Biden? And the answer is, well, we see.
Well, he's mystical. All is one, right? All is one.
And matter. I agree with Joseph Farrell, who says that, his senility is not because of some old age. I mean, we are in an age where that can get treated. It's because of all the evil he's done throughout his life has just shattered his brain. So, it's just, again, he's part of a bloodthirsty group of people that have been in Congress too long. And like you said, they wait their turns and the establishment will put them in there. Mitt Romney was an example. And who was the guy who ran against Clinton? What's his name?
Dole.
Bob Dole. Yeah, I mean, just because it was his turn, but he was a terrible politician. Just, again, this whole group of neocons, neoliberals, it's just ridiculous.
Well, that's the funny thing with Dole is he had a real shot of winning it and probably would have if it wasn't for Newt Gingrich.
Really?
Newt stabbed Bob Dole in the back in between the Republican convention and the Democratic convention by cutting a political deal with Clinton that went directly against Dole. And it was basically taking the winds out of Dole's whole campaign after the convention was over and giving this huge, big deal to Clinton to use going into the Democratic convention.
No, I don't remember that, but.
No, it's one of those two silly things like that stick out. That, and I can't totally hate Bob Dole because, he kind of likes Britney Spears. If you remember those ads, yeah. I was going to say, but he had a sense of humor about himself. You know, it's. And that's one of the things with those people is the ones actually running for me aren't really so much the problem. It's the one setting the agenda.
You know, because they're just puppets for globalists at the end of the day.
Shadow government. Yes.
Well, for the most part these days, they try to find people that are blank shakes, you know, blank slates.
Right.
Where they have no voting record. They have, you know, nothing that's not, you know, crowd tested and, you know, that they're saying all the right words and people are going to read into them whatever they want. And it's like this one my father explained politics to me as a child, and part of it is I can't get that out of my head. And he was a lifelong independent and made me one. It's the right recipe for America got torn in half pretty much at World War II. One part, you know, Democrats took half, Republicans took the other half. They both run on their half of what right for America. Mm-hmm. As soon as one of them wins, what do they enact? The other half, which is what we said about, you know, Biden and Trump, enrich ourselves, enrich our families, enrich our campaign contributors. And so they're sitting there and they're feeding at the trough and the other party's out of power. So they rightly point and say, hey, they're not doing what's right for America. They're just enriching themselves. Here's our, you know, they tout their half and say, you know, got to switch for this. And your typical American says, yeah, they're feeding off the trough. Yeah, that's what needs to be happening. And it's not. I'm going to vote for the other side this time. And then, you know, they vote for the other side. And when they get into power, American public shocked. That second half of the agenda, where it's the enriching everybody goes in. And then the other side starts saying, hey, look what they're doing. Here's our good half that's not getting, you know. And you keep getting it's basically this good cop, bad cop. And if you notice, I'm not listing which side's which. Yeah, and it's just they keep going back. And each time they get a chunk out of the American public and they keep losing. And when my father explained that to me and I looked around, I said, yeah, that's true. And then, you know, my uncle was a politician. I met the people he was around. And it's like, yeah, my father's right. That's exactly how these people are. They don't have a soul. You know, it's like that there's only one thing that's unforgivable in a politician, not staying sold. Once you've sold yourself, you need to stay sold. If you sell your vote on something, you can't switch.
Yeah, your dad was a wise man, and hopefully more will wake up to this reality because, well, here we are. We're going to go the way of Atlantis and the way of ancient Egypt, and we won't even be remembered like the Egyptians. So, except for our comic books. So, and the Nazis and the Iron Skies were still hiding there. But anyway, what?
The Nazis are still in Antarctica. You know that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Of course. So awesome. Well, I think we better wrap it up. Good questions from the audience, as always. You guys rock. Good comments. I hope you have enjoyed the show. Another great AB Live. To repeat, tomorrow is AB Live with Danielle Dulski on the season of The Witch will be postponed because she is suffering from the Rona. She's getting better, but she's lost her voice. So we'll hopefully schedule it for next week. To commemorate, season of The Witch and the fall. And this show, the audio version will be out and hopefully tomorrow, latest by Saturday. YouTube version will be out and it'll also be out on Rockfin, Odyssey, and a few other places. So I hope you've enjoyed, and please support this show. Again, for those who subscribe to the private RSS feed for Aeon Byte, we will be changing the password on October 1st, so look out for it. So I think that's all I got. So first of all, Vance, thanks for keeping us company tonight.
Okay. It was very interesting. Sometimes maybe we'll dig under that pyramid and find out what's in there. And good talk to you again, Grandpa. My regards. And always good to hang with you guys.
Yeah, likewise. And Graham, thanks for coming on. Another great show. And we should plan for a comic book movie extravaganza for our next chat.
Absolutely, absolutely. Always a pleasure, Vance. It's great to see you guys. And be excellent to each other and party on, dudes.
Party on, Garth. And for the rest of you, thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. And as always, write your own gospel and live your own myth. Take care and enjoy the rest of the fall. And I mean that by the season and humanity. But take care, everyone. Good night.